friends. You're listening to How the West Was Cast, a podcast dedicated to the best of the Western movie genre.
The white man has made many promises to us, yet they keep only one. They promised to take our land from us, and they took it. You see the suffering and the misery they bring to your people, yet you bring one to us to nurse back to health? Tonto, why?
Nobody has reason to fill their hearts with hatred for the white man more than I. He's taken from me my wife and my child. But the man I brought here is my brother, and I will protect his life with my own if I have to. And if I'm wrong, and he proves to be an enemy, then I, Tonto, will decorate my lance with his white man's hair. But until that day comes, let him not be judged by his color, but by his heart, as a man and a friend.
That was a scene from the underrated 1981 Western, The Legend of the Lone Ranger, which we'll be discussing today on How the West Was Cast. Hello, my name is Matthew Chernoff, and I'm a screenwriter and an entertainment journalist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Andrew Patrick Nelson, a film historian and the chair of the Department of Film and Media Arts at the University of Utah.
Now, if you enjoy our show, why not follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook? You can find us at Western Podcast. That's at, as in the at symbol, Western Podcast, all one word. Tell us about your favorite 80s Western, and you just might hear us discuss it on a future show. Okay then, Andrew, why don't you set the scene and give us some backstory on today's film?
The blockbuster success of Star Wars in 1977 sent movie studios scrambling for similar juvenile content they could bring to the big screen. Within a few years, audiences were treated to new feature-length renditions of Superman, Star Trek, and a host of other properties from pop culture's past. Jack Rather, the millionaire Texas oil man turned television producer, saw opportunity. He had long owned the rights to a number of treasured characters from 50s television who he felt would resonate with contemporary audiences. One character in particular seemed especially suited to this moment of cultural nostalgia and escapist adventure. That character was the Lone Ranger, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains who led the fight for law and order in the early Western United States, on radio and television at least. In 1977, Rather signed an agreement with the eccentric British media mogul Lou Grade to co-finance and co-produce The Legend of the Lone Ranger. Many pieces quickly fell into place, including director William A. Fraker, cinematographer Laszlo Kovacs, composer John Barry, and supporting actors Christopher Lloyd, Jason Robards, and Michael Horse. For the all-important part of The Lone Ranger, the producers followed the template established by Superman the movie and cast a young, attractive, but unknown actor in the lead, Clinton Spilsbury. The son of a legendary Arizona football coach, Spilsbury had dropped out of university in the early 1970s and moved to Hollywood. "I remember the day he walked into my office," recalled John Crosby, Spilsbury's first agent. "To this day, I think he is the most striking man I have ever put my eyes on, and a terrific fellow on top of all that. It was like he walked in on a white horse. He was as close as you could come in real life to the Lone Ranger." As production ramped up, the movie's personnel emphasized that this would be a respectful treatment of both the Lone Ranger character and the Western genre. As Walter Koblenz, one of the movie's producers, told a reporter in 1980, "This is a grand old Western in the heroic and glorious style of the cowboy picture. This is not Blazing Saddles." Invoking Superman's famous tagline, "You'll believe a man can fly," Koblenz added, "When he puts on his mask, you're going to believe it." But at the same time producers were reassuring fans that this would be the Lone Ranger movie they wanted, Jack Rather was alienating those fans. With Rather's consent, Clayton Moore, who played the Lone Ranger in the 1950s television series, had for years been making promotional appearances as the character, in full costume. With a new Lone Ranger movie on the horizon, Moore, though in his mid-60s, began suggesting that he should once again play the Ranger. When Moore refused to stop appearing as the character, Rather sued and won a court order that prevented Moore from wearing the iconic black mask in public. The legal victory backfired, angering longtime fans who still adored Moore. Negative press continued to dog the movie throughout principal photography. Though not a troubled production by, say, Heaven's Gate standards, a stuntman was seriously injured filming a stunt in Monument Valley, and Spilsbury's on-set difficulties and off-screen behavior began to alienate much of the cast and crew and worry the film's producers. An extended period of post-production delayed the movie's release from Christmas 1980 to Memorial Day 1981. But as the new release date neared, and the movie's production difficulties faded from memory, enthusiasm began to build. Test screenings were positive. In the scene where Spilsbury appears in costume for the first time and the famous William Tell overture begins to play, audiences would erupt with applause. After one test screening, Universal Studios president Sid Sheinberg told Koblenz that the movie was previewing better than Jaws. The Legend of the Lone Ranger opened in wide release on May 22, 1981. Whatever hope its makers had for success were quickly and emphatically dashed. Critics savaged everything about the film, from its uninspired performances to its slow pacing, to its inconsistent and confused tone, to the fact that the Lone Ranger doesn't actually appear until halfway through the movie. New York Times reviewer Janet Maslin offered what is perhaps the ultimate Western insult, writing that the movie bids strongly for a niche in the Heaven's Gate Hall of Fame. Though I must say I prefer Time Out London's appraisal. Flabbily inept, saddled with flavorless performances, and an off-screen narrator who elucidates an already painfully limpid plot like a nanny explaining to a child. Needless to say, The Legend of the Lone Ranger bombed at the box office. Moviegoers who flocked to see superheroes and spaceships weren't interested in the masked rider of the plains. In a summer that saw the release of hits like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Superman 2, Cannonball Run, and Stripes, the movie quickly disappeared from movie screens. And then from memory. Spilsbury never made another film. It wasn't until 2013, with another troubled attempt to revive The Lone Ranger on the horizon, that interest in The Legend of the Lone Ranger briefly grew. "Looking back, I feel that we were trying to please everyone from 6 to 60, said producer Koblenz then. It was too violent for little kids and not sophisticated enough for an older audience. Maybe we were too intent on staying true to the Lone Ranger story. You could say that, if Heaven's Gate killed the Western, The Legend of the Lone Ranger hammered the final nail in the coffin. But you shouldn't, for many reasons, including the fact that interest in Westerns had nothing to do with either movie being made. Heaven's Gate was made because its producers believed that an Academy Award-winning director was about to deliver a modern American classic on par with Gone with the Wind. The Legend of the Lone Ranger was made to cash in on a lucrative trend. This is, of course, the exact same reason why Disney made a Lone Ranger movie in 2013. The Legend of the Lone Ranger offers us an unexpected but instructive lens on how little movies have changed over the past 40 years. Now, for this episode, we've each chosen five key elements of the film that we want to highlight and discuss. These can be anything from a specific performance or a favorite scene or a line of dialogue or a theme that we think is especially noteworthy. All right, Matt, what is your number five?
My number five is John Barry's score. Now, as I've mentioned on previous episodes, I'm a lifelong James Bond fan, so it should come as no surprise when I say that John Barry is my favorite film composer. His scores just speak to me in a way that no other composers do, and I'm talking here about far more than just his James Bond music. If you ask me, the scores that Barry wrote for Born Free, The Lion in Winter, and Out of Africa are really some of the finest movie music ever written. His lesser-known scores to films like King Kong and Indecent Proposal and even Howard the Duck are ones that I return to over and over again, year after year. Now, before writing the music for The Legend of the Lone Ranger, Barry scored two Westerns. The first, not coincidentally, was for director William Fraker's 1970 film Monty Walsh, and the second was for the 1977 Charles Bronson adventure The White Buffalo. Barry's most acclaimed Western score is, of course, the one that he wrote for Dances with Wolves. His incredible music on that film earned him his fourth of five Academy Awards for Best Original Score, and deservedly so. It's a genuine masterpiece that elegantly captures the sense of grandeur and beauty of the South Dakota prairie. As for Legend of the Lone Ranger, think about this for a minute. The film was shot in 1980 and released in 81. During those 2 years alone, Barry scored seven movies, including bona fide classics like Somewhere in Time and Body Heat. What's curious about his Lone Ranger score is that it emphasizes the story's romance rather than its swashbuckling elements. Relying on his signature long-line themes and string-laden melodies, Barry crafts a surprisingly gentle score here, one that's less concerned with moving the action along than it is with capturing a nostalgic tone. Although some might grumble about that, I think it nicely complements a film that is essentially a sentimental ode to a bygone era. The opening track is appropriately titled The Man in the Mask, and it introduces the film's central theme, which Barry then weaves in interesting ways throughout the rest of the score. His affection for repetition and memorable hooks is on full display here, and after listening to it several times in preparation for this episode, I find myself humming it nonstop wherever I go. That's part of the magic of John Barry. The score also contains several standout tracks, including a beautiful piece of music called The Breaking of Silver, which, to my ear, offers a teasing hint of what we'd be treated to 9 years later in Dances with Wolves. That track is followed up by one called Ambush, which is actually mistitled. In reality, it's a continuation of the music from the horse-breaking scene, but whoever produced the original soundtrack album apparently mislabeled it in 1981, and that's how it stayed ever since. What I love most about that piece of music, Ambush, is the way it recalls the swirling, circular sound that Barry used so effectively in his score to Disney's The Black Hole 2 years earlier. It really is a hypnotic motif and fits that horse-breaking scene perfectly. Now, there are two things that disappoint me about Barry's score. The first is that it's all too brief. The film's official soundtrack clocks in at just under 27 minutes, which means that there's not a lot here to chew on, but perhaps that's the result of scoring so many films in such a short amount of time. The main thing that disappoints me, however, are the corny lyrics to Man in the Mask. Written by Oscar winner Dean Pitchford and sung by Merle Haggard, Man in the Mask would have worked far better as an instrumental only. Honestly, Paul Jones' folksy harmonica solo is more than enough to get the point across without those cringy lyrics. Other than that, though, I think Barry's score is one of the best things about The Legend of the Lone Ranger. What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I'll save my thoughts about the balladeering, if that's a word, of the great Merle Haggard for a moment. I like this score a lot. I should point out that it's available on Amazon Prime for subscribers out there. I've been listening to it myself for the past week in the car and as I've been walking around, and it is a great score that does stay with you. There's a lot to like in it. I think it does a really masterful job of blending the orchestral elements with some more conventional Western touches, the harmonica, as you noted, but also some guitar. I think it really is an interesting synthesis of different traditions associated with the Western, and I think that's something we'll probably talk more about today. So I quite like the score. Now, I can't let you talk about the score, though, without asking your opinion about perhaps a more incongruous piece of music, yet one that is inextricably linked to the Lone Ranger character. And that is, of course, the William Tell Overture, right? Which we now know as the theme to the Lone Ranger has been by this point for, I guess, over 30 years. And it appears in the film at particular moments, but Barry does not try to weave the William Tell Overture into the rest of the film. It just kind of appears at particular moments. One review I read of this film suggested that hearing the William Tell Overture in the middle of this movie is the equivalent to had we heard the 1960s Batman TV theme in the 1989 Tim Burton movie. I don't know if I believe that or not, but what say you about the William Tell Overture?
I think the way that it's deployed here is reminiscent more of the James Bond movies, where we get that classic Bond theme that would drop in and out of each film. Early in that series, it would happen whenever Connery was walking through an airport or just any old scene, they would just drop it in. And later on, as the franchise evolved, they would use it for key moments, as they do here in Legend. I think the first time we hear it is when he turns around and is finally wearing the mask. And then we hear it again during scenes where he's galloping across the prairie to get to somewhere. It's transitional music that's used. And it really does heighten the film, I think, when we hear it. It's like hearing the Superman theme when it comes in. And I appreciated that it was used sparingly. I'm not sure about the Batman thing. I think that that seems like it would be a wrong move.
Sure.
But I think it works well here. And you think what?
I actually agree with you for all the reasons you cited. And I think, you know, with respect to Batman or really any other film that tries to update an older property or was doing so around this time, there's a closer connection between The Legend of the Lone Ranger and the old Lone Ranger television show and radio serial than there is between, you know, say, Superman or later on Batman. So I like it. I guess I'd also be remiss here if I didn't make the classic joke about what the definition of a snob is. And a snob is somebody who hears the theme to The Lone Ranger and tells you that it's the William Tell Overture.
Wow. I've never heard that before. Is that something people actually say to each other? That's pretty good.
Well, you know, I get a lot of mileage out of it at parties.
Now, on another podcast that I contribute to, we interviewed Barry's longtime friend and agent, Richard Kraft, and he said something during that interview that I thought was particularly interesting. He said, John Barry scores a film's attitude, not its action. And I think that holds true for his work here in Legend of the Lone Ranger. He's not constantly hitting you over the head with one action cue after another or providing, you know, corny stingers that just pump up the action in a fake way. He's really capturing a nostalgic attitude, and he does it really well. Yet somehow he earned a Golden Raspberry Award in 1981 for this score, which just shows how truly absurd those awards are.
Well, there's something to be said for critics just really piling on this film in every capacity in a way that was completely out of proportion to what the movie was. I've read a few more recent pieces of commentary that suggest that critics and filmmakers had a longer memory than audiences and were coming to Clayton Moore's defense or something like that. But who knows? But I agree, completely out of proportion. And as for that, you know, description of him scoring a film's attitude, I think that's really well put. And that approach fits this movie very well because it is a somewhat leisurely paced film in certain respects. And that's certainly something critics pointed to as a negative, but all these years later, I don't see it that way.
So what I'd like to do right now is play a track from the score. It's a short piece of music called The Valley Chase. And between its powerful horn section, its rhythmic bass strings, and its subtle use of military drums in the background, it's actually one of the more James Bondian cues on the soundtrack. So let's give it a listen. Okay, Andrew, so what is your number five?
My number five is the rhyming narration performed by Merle Haggard. The famous country musician appears, vocally at least, in The Legend of the Lone Ranger as the Balladeer, an unseen narrator who pops up 12 times over the course of the film to offer rhyming descriptions of what we're seeing. And as you noted, Haggard also sings the title theme, The Man in the Mask. Now, as you know, Matt, I went all in on Merle Haggard early on when we were planning this episode. And I must confess that I'm still, even after watching the film many times, a little perplexed about why this decision was made. The Time Out review I quoted earlier is certainly correct that the narration never tells us anything we don't already know. It is entirely redundant. Now, Haggard is a country music legend, but none of his hits prior to this point are about the Old West. His songs were about drinking and disappointing your mother. And as you pointed out, Haggard didn't write the narration. The words were penned by Pitchford, who, of course, had written the Irene Cara hit Fame. So it's not as though Haggard was drawing in necessarily a huge country music audience. Now, I am admittedly not an authority on the Lone Ranger, but if there's a precedent for this type of narration in any earlier version of the character, I'm not aware of it. Now, it could be that the narration is meant to recall, if obliquely, the narration of the original radio show. But the show's narration was not in rhyme. So I wonder then if this is not an example of the movie's embrace of a mythical presentation of American history. Now that has always been a part of the Lone Ranger character. The introduction of the radio show included the following line. The stories of his strength and courage, his daring and resourcefulness have come down to us through the generations, and nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Note how this positions the Lone Ranger as essentially part of an oral tradition. That no greater hero can be found in the pages of history is an acknowledgement that the Lone Ranger cannot be found in the pages of history. Now, I might be giving the movie a little too much credit here, though. What say you?
I don't know. I'll say this about his contribution. It's interesting, which, you know, whether it works or not, it's up to each individual viewer. I've never heard anybody who really loved it, but I appreciate anything that's sort of unique in a film like this, where it feels a little prepackaged and everything. It just stands out as a quirky little affect. Unfortunately, the rhymes are so bad. They're just so, I mean, a lot of them don't even rhyme. They're just like, he's reaching for the rhyme and they're kind of clunky. It's also interesting to imagine the scenes without the rhymes, because I think they would play so much better. One of them really interrupts a cool moment. It's the first time that the ranger and Tonto ride into town at night, and the ranger pauses for a second outside of the newspaper office and watches Amy Stryker working late at night. And it's a cool moment. It's like a Batman moment where he's hiding in the darkness, spying on the woman he can't have. And yet during it, we hear one of those corny limericks, and it saps that entire scene of all that emotional power that might have made it such a neat moment, and that's just gone.
Now John Reed was just a memory. The masked man had taken his place. But that doesn't mean his heart wasn't touched when he saw Amy Stryker's face. Amy had stayed to do her uncle's work and to keep his dreams alive. But unless the masked man could find Cavendish, true justice would never survive.
Okay, Matt, what is your fourth thing about The Legend of the Lone Ranger?
So my number four is Sir Lew Grade. Now, although I was only 14 years old when I first saw Legend of the Lone Ranger in a movie theater, one of the main reasons why I was excited to see the movie was because it was produced by Lew Grade. To me, the name Lew Grade, or Lord Grade, as he's actually credited on the film, conjured up images of all-star casts and foreign intrigue and hundreds of extras. That's because from 1976 until 1980, Grade specialized in producing macho adventures about war and disaster. During that four-year period, he really cornered the market on the kind of large-scale international co-productions that I was obsessed with as a teenager. To me, low-grade films like The Cassandra Crossing, March or Die, and Escape to Athena were what movies were all about. In fact, two of his films from that period, the 1978 thriller The Medusa Touch and the 1980 undersea adventure Raise the Titanic, rank high on my list of favorites, which might sound strange because, like Legend of the Lone Ranger, both were critical and commercial bombs. In some ways, though, my fondness for Grade's films is best summed up by the man himself, who once said, "All of my movies are great. Some of them are bad, but they're all great." Personally, I couldn't agree more. As far as his connection to The Legend of the Lone Ranger goes, it's not hard to see why the project might have appealed to him. The Ranger's instantly recognizable name and image are exactly what producers like Grade dream about. Also, having produced TV shows like The Saint, Thunderbirds, and Space 1999 early in his career, as well as feature films like The Muppet Movie and The Dark Crystal, Grade definitely understood the value of tapping into the kid-friendly market, which is clearly what he had in mind for The Lone Ranger. And considering that he produced Raise the Titanic 1 year before The Ranger, I get the sense that Grade was looking to launch a franchise of his own. Raise the Titanic was, after all, part of a series of popular Dirk Pitt adventure novels written by Clive Cussler, and if the film had been a success at the box office, we might have been treated to a long-running movie series. But, as was frequently the case around this time period, Lou Grade's gamble didn't quite pay off, and The Lone Ranger became yet another costly flop on his resume. Which is a real shame, because, boy, would I have enjoyed seeing a whole series of Lou Grade westerns throughout the 1980s.
Yeah, Grade is a really interesting character in many respects. I think you did a great job of summarizing the kind of triangulation that he was clearly trying to do at this point in his career, building on a number of different things and not being able to really quite bring them together in a way that might have enabled him to have a kind of great last phase of his career. If I'm remembering this right, he also made Saturn III.
Right.
The Farrah Fawcett, Kirk Douglas science fiction picture around the same time as Race the Titanic and Legend of the Lone Ranger. So he really had three good tries at trying to do what was popular at that time, right? The kind of a novel adaptation of an adventure character, the science fiction film, and then the kind of the nostalgic throwback to serialized narratives from yesteryear. And none of them worked. You know, films like the Dark Crystal are after this. So it's not as though he didn't have success. But this is certainly an interesting moment where there's, a kind of dead end or maybe an alternative future, like you said, where in some other timeline, we not only have all these great Clive Cussler adaptations, but also, you know, by this point, who knows how many Clinton Spilsbury Lone Ranger adventures.
Well, you mentioned Superman the movie in your introduction. So in a way, you could almost compare Lou Grade to Alexander Salkind. I think both of them shared a certain level of showmanship when it came to producing movies, and both were real characters, you know, like Dino De Laurentiis and Sam Goldwyn. Grade was really an old-school movie mogul, famous for making risky handshake deals and announcing, you know, two dozen projects each year at the Cannes Film Festival, all while puffing away on a legendary 9-inch cigar that was became his trademark. Although he was often mocked for some of his choices and the quality of his film, he did manage to lend his name to some really good movies throughout his career, including Sophie's Choice and On Golden Pond. He produced one other notable Western in his career, and that was the year after Lone Ranger. He produced 1982's Barbarossa with Willie Nelson and Gary Busey. And as far as him being called Lord Grade, that's because Grade was knighted for his work in 1969, his work in the entertainment industry. And he passed away in 1998 at the age of 91. I think the phrase, "they don't make him like him anymore," is entirely accurate when it comes to Lou Grade.
Lord Grade arrived for work this morning at 5:30, as usual. The sprightly 74-year-old workaholic is head and soul of the entertainment empire ACC, an empire in trouble since Lord Grade moved into the feature film business. With Raise the Titanic, the company ran aground and was left with a £7 million net loss. And the latest Muppets film, a dependably cheerful success, had to be mortgaged. Then last week came the news that Jack Gill, the number two at ACC, was to go. He'd been the methodical financial counterweight to Lord Grade's flair. So ACC shareholders came to today's yearly meeting with worries about the company's future. But there was little the average shareholder could do, because under the Independent Broadcasting Authority rules, over 99% of the shares carry no vote. Anyway, Lord Grade, bursting with confidence, fended off the questions.
Okay, Andrew, what is your number four?
My number four is Laszlo Kovacs cinematography and what it means. The Legend of the Lone Ranger cinematography is, in a word, soft. It is so soft. It is Emmanuel soft. It is Michael McDonald era Doobie Brothers soft, which is unexpected. Because soft is not an adjective we associate with the Western. Yet, here we are. And the softness is not only the product of the soft focus cinematography and high-key lighting. At every opportunity, in nearly every scene of the movie, Kovacs and crew find ways to diffuse the light. I have never seen a film with so much fog, haze, mist, dust, and smoke. Now, the reason for doing all of this seems pretty obvious to me. It gives the film a dreamlike quality, in keeping with its aim of being deliberately old-fashioned, even reverential. Yet, as with soft, dreamlike is not a quality we usually associate with the Western. Instead, Westerns are about history, and the history of the genre is, in a sense, a history of successive claims to truth. Nearly every Western movie purports, implicitly or explicitly, to offer a more truthful, complex, and historically accurate representation of the past than did earlier movies, which were limited by the biases of and aesthetic conventions of their times in a way that contemporary movies are somehow not. The Western's visual conventions have, of course, changed along with cinemas, especially conventions governing what is considered realistic. Yet, whether in black and white or Warner color, Western cinematography usually offers us clear, vivid, sharply focused windows on the past, with an emphasis on rendering details like the scale and shape of the landscape or the minutiae of costume and equipment. The Legend of the Lone Ranger serves up countless, beautifully composed shots of familiar Western settings and set pieces, majestic vistas of Monument Valley, familiar interiors like bunkhouses and town newspapers, the robbery of a stagecoach, an ambush in a box canyon, the dynamiting of the villain's fortress, and so on. Yet the soft-focus cinematography makes these familiar images, well, unfamiliar. The fine details usually so crucial to Westerns are obscured by the haze of time and memory. It's a striking visual experience. If the film's look deliberately evokes nostalgia, that seems completely at odds with the movie's parallel aim of believability, the conviction that, as Fraker told an interviewer in 1980, the movie would only succeed if audiences believed the Lone Ranger was real and not a made-up lawman in a fantasy Old West. I'm tempted to say that, contrary to their public statements, the film's makers went all in on nostalgia, acknowledging and embracing a rose-colored view of the Old West, and in so doing, maybe even offering something approaching a criticism of similar films that instead offer nostalgia disguised as truth. Or maybe the film is just conflicted.
Well, softness is definitely an understatement. I mean, some shots are literally hard to see what's happening, especially the Day of the Dead nighttime sequence where it's at night and there's this wind blowing in and everybody's in costume. It's hard to tell exactly who's who. I find Kovacs' cinematography here reminiscent of Vilmos Zsigmond's work on McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Heaven's Gate, but it's not quite as epic as those. Each of those films, though, occasionally has that soft focus, dusty sheen. Of course, in the case of Heaven's Gate, Cimino infamously insisted on layering filter after filter in front of the lens until the image was so dim and muddy you could barely make it out. One thing I want to pay special note to here is the substantial number of excellent split diopter shots that we get throughout this film, which really are one of my favorite visual gimmicks of the time period. The late 70s and early 80s were just a fruitful time for diopter shots, with filmmakers like Brian De Palma and Clint Eastwood using them nonstop in the films they directed. It's any filmmaker who puts this many diopter shots in their films gets extra points in my book.
Yeah, there's clearly a lot of intentionality behind the cinematography. And, you know, comparing this film to, you know, some other, let's say, cinematographically notable Westerns from around the same time, like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Heaven's Gate, you know, those Westerns are usually modifying their image in order to accord with our sense of historical photographs, right? The idea that you're trying to make the film look like what we consider to be historical at this moment in time. One thing I've written about is how a lot of Westerns from the 60s and 70s include this type of imagery. So to make images look like they're from an old newspaper or from an old photograph. This is not that. This is something entirely different that really has nothing to do with history, but has everything to do with dream and memory, which sets the film apart from nearly every other Western. Okay, Matt, what's your third thing?
My number three is the film's gloomy poster art. Okay, so here's a pro tip for you. When you're launching what you hope will be the first film in a potentially long-running franchise, one of the key elements that you've got to nail down correctly is the poster. In the case of the Lone Ranger movie, the poster has to attract younger viewers who aren't yet aware of the character, while not alienating older fans who grew up with him. Basically, as the saying goes, you only get one chance to make a first impression, and for a film like this, the poster is that one chance. Which is why it's so strange that the producers of The Legend of the Lone Ranger would commission such a drab, dark, and boring poster. The weird thing is they actually hired the right artist for the job, or more correctly, artists, plural. The film's official poster was designed and painted by the late American illustrator Richard Amsel, and it's not hard to see why they tapped him for the job. Amsel is one of the greatest movie poster artists of the 1970s. He's responsible for classic posters for films like The Sting, Chinatown, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. As far as Westerns go, he created the amazing posters for The Shootist, The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, to name just a few. His best work has a timeless quality, utilizing warm, glowing colors to great effect. And yet, the poster that he created for The Legend of the Lone Ranger is almost entirely black. It consists of nothing more than the Lone Ranger's face lurking in the shadows and a gleaming silver bullet. On the plus side, his mask looks pretty good, and I like the glint of light that sparks off the tip of the bullet, but the Ranger's black leather glove holding that bullet looks to me like it belongs on the hand of a killer in a slasher movie rather than a Western hero. In fact, it's hard to tell at first if this is a poster for the Lone Ranger or He Knows You're Alone. Now, I don't blame Richard Amsel for this mistake. The fault here is clearly with the producers, who apparently didn't know what they wanted. And I say that because they originally hired a different artist to work on the film's poster, and that artist is the legendary Drew Struzan. Now, Struzan is arguably the most famous movie poster artist of all time. You've seen his work on posters for Back to the Future, John Carpenter's The Thing, and Risky Business, not to mention half a dozen Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies. After being hired to create the poster for The Lone Ranger, Struzan produced 9 concept drawings, each one suitable for framing. You can see 4 of those drawings in a stunning coffee table book called The Art of Drew Struzan, which I highly recommend. For The Lone Ranger poster concepts, Struzan portrayed the Ranger side by side with Tonto, both of them surrounded by colorful scenes from the film. His drawings are bright and gorgeous and would have been 1,000 times better than the monochromatic placeholder that we ended up with instead. Today, Struzan sums his Lone Ranger experience up this way, and I quote, "Whether the studio wanted it slicker or more photographic or just didn't understand, I have no idea, because they never called me back. But that studio's for you." Again, such a missed opportunity.
I wasn't aware of the Struzan concept art. So I looked it up after you said that this was going to be one of your subjects. And of course, those posters, even in their rough form, are superior in every respect to what we got. They are, of course, much more of the times, you know, the large heads, dominating the scene, characters sort of in the mid-ground, engaged in certain actions. You know, it's really actually the kind of template that was used for at least one of the posters of Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Definitely. Same kind of thing. Yep. And this is the moment that they're trying to evoke. I'm aware of a second promotional poster for The Legend of the Lone Ranger, which is full color and shows the Ranger on silver and kind of the high-o silver moment with a different tagline that reads, the film where you hiss the villain and cheer the hero. And I wasn't able to find out when that poster came out relative to the Giallo poster, let's say. But I can't help but imagine it came out after and is a kind of tacit acknowledgement that that original poster didn't quite convey what the filmmakers were hoping to.
From that time period, I don't remember that other poster. I've seen it since then, but back then that was not a poster that
you
we
ever saw.
No, yeah. It wasn't on anything. In fact, all the merchandise from the film, the toys and the action figures and stuff like that, all use a variation on the Richard Amsel one. Except what's weird is they had somebody else redraw it. It's not the same image. I don't know if they just didn't get the rights to use his artwork on anything other than the poster, but somebody recreated it in a weaker looking image. I mean, it looks kind of amateurish the way it's drawn, but it is that face and the darkness looming out. And that's what appeared on kids' toys, which it really does not look like a fun toy to play with, especially because you've got this magnificent white stallion that you could incorporate and all this Native American imagery, a vintage train and action scenes. And instead they go with, as you said, this creepy Dario Argento looking thing. It's like this weird epic blunder.
On the night before her wedding, every girl is frightened. And this time, there's good reason. He knows you're alone.
My number three is William A. Fraker's direction. Fraker was famously one of a group of cinematographers that included Vilmos Zsigmond and Laszlo Kovacs, who rose up through the ranks in the waning days of the studio system and helped usher in the new Hollywood of the 1970s. His impressive list of credits includes Rosemary's Baby, Bullet, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Close Encounters of a Third Kind. Fraker had a reputation as a perfectionist who would go to great lengths to get the right shot, but he was also known to be an easygoing and even calming influence on big-budget sets, and he devoted considerable time over the course of his career to mentoring aspiring cinematographers. Now, at this point, 1979, Fraker had only directed two movies, but one of them was Monty Walsh, one of the best westerns of the 1970s, that managed to imbue a very familiar story, aging cowboys confronting changing times, with a renewed sensitivity and relevance. The tremendous feel he demonstrated for the western and its thematic nuances, coupled with his strong visual sensibility, seen in a variety of films across a range of movies in the 60s and 70s, made Fraker a good choice to helm The Legend of the Lone Ranger. He also had a professional connection to the character. One of Fraker's first jobs in Hollywood was as a camera assistant on the Lone Ranger television series in 1956 and 57. So it was a homecoming of sorts for the cinematographer turned director. The Legend of the Lone Ranger includes a number of major set pieces, including a stagecoach robbery, a train holdup, and the climactic assault on Cavendish's fortress. All are competently staged on a grand scale. On the performance side, the knock against any cinematographer who moves to the director's chair is that they aren't actors' directors, and we certainly find this criticism in appraisals of The Legend of the Lone Ranger. Yet, Monty Walsh had proved that Fraker was more than capable of handling experienced performers like Lee Marvin and Jack Palance. Aside from Spilsbury, who we'll talk about in a bit, the acting in The Legend of the Lone Ranger is, on balance, entertaining. Yes, it may be that Jason Robards was phoning in his performance, but I'd talk to Jason Robards on the phone any day. In short, there's nothing in The Legend of the Lone Ranger that suggests Fraker didn't have the chops needed to direct and direct successfully. But after The Legend of the Lone Ranger, Fraker never directed another feature film, and instead returned to cinematography, working steadily until the early 2000s, including shooting Tombstone in 1993.
I agree with you about his work on the action scenes in particular. I get really caught up in some of those sequences, the train sequence where the guys are jumping off the mountain onto the top of it. And I get the feeling that he just sort of let his stuntmen loose, because there are some stunts in here that are pretty harrowing. I know somebody got injured severely. I think it was the stuntman who climbs under the stagecoach at the beginning
yeah.
and goes underneath them. I mean, it's a remarkable stunt when he jumps onto the front horse on the stagecoach and then climbs underneath them. The film sort of pauses,
yeah.
just lets us marvel at this thing, and then he falls. I think he really ended up seriously injured after that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the infamous stories from the production. So this happened really early on in production. The stuntman's name is Terry Leonard. He was a legendary stuntman who'd been in El Dorado and Apocalypse Now. And that stunt was an attempt to top the famous Yakima Canutt under the horses scene from John Ford's Stagecoach. And the thought was that in the Canutt stunt, it happened so quickly that you didn't appreciate just how dangerous it was for a stuntman to dangle beneath six or eight galloping horses and then let go. So the idea was for the stuntman to stay under there a little bit longer, hold on, have the camera hold on him, and then he would let go. And what ended up happening was one of Leonard's legs was run over by the wagon wheels. So Leonard has talked about this, and he says that his first thought was that his legs had been cut off.
Unbelievable.
That he was, you know, scared to look down at his legs for fear of what he might see or not see. So, but he survived. He was airlifted to hospital and actually returned to the set by the end of shooting for more fun. Not of the same caliber, but still, I mean, really a remarkable stunt. It's in the picture, of course, because they only got one take.
Yeah, it's great that they used the take. I feel like there's a thought in filmmaking that if somebody gets injured, they don't use that take. I often hear that, but they just went for it here, and rightly so. It's jaw-dropping when he does it. And the train sequence, I think, like I mentioned, has a Spielbergian quality to it, which makes sense, having worked with him on films like 1941. And, mm-hmm. and I think it's a really cool-looking movie. The acting, like you said, it's hard to say how much of that is him not paying attention or just the actors not being capable of delivering a decent performance or just not really trying. Another action sequence I think that stands out, though, is the opening attack on John Reed's home, which, because you're a big Conan fan, something about that scene reminds me of the early scene of young Conan's village being attacked. I feel like maybe it inspired that, or there's a real similarity between those two sequences.
Yeah. Well, so this film comes out 1 year before Conan the Barbarian. What I would say is that both of those films are indebted to The Searchers. The Searchers' traumatic assault on the family home becomes a common feature of Western films over the course of the 1960s, and in particular the 1970s. So to me, that's one of the film's many references to John Ford's films.
Now, you mentioned the pacing as an issue earlier in the episode, and I think that's true depending on what you're looking to get out of this film. For me, I think the pace works fairly well, especially for an origin story like this. It takes its time to establish things. Fraker plants seeds throughout it early on that we can see why John Reed makes these decisions and ends up becoming the ranger. It has a deliberately leisurely pace at times, but I think that works for origin story. So there's a lot to like here in his direction.
Yeah, I don't actually have a problem with the pacing either. one thing that I mentioned earlier was, critics were upset, some of them at least, about having to wait around for half the movie before the Lone Ranger actually showed up. Now, the origin presented here is one that audiences had seen before in Lone Ranger narratives. The Cavendish character is the villain, the assault on Reed's family, and then him emerging as a Lone Ranger. But I think it may be because that the Lone Ranger had appeared literally thousands of times in different media, that he much more so than, say, Superman, isn't really associated with a particular origin story. So you have a film that goes really all in on the origin story, of course anticipating that there's going to be a James Bond-like number of Lone Ranger films after this. But it goes all in on it, whereas audiences had never demonstrated a great interest in the origins of the Lone Ranger, or how those origins might have made him special. He's, unlike Superman, not from another planet. There isn't as much there. So I think having to wait around so long drew critics' attention to some of the other sort of more leisurely aspects of the film. But to me, taken today, I think the pacing is actually wholly appropriate and is actually handled in a way that makes the action scenes more exciting because you actually feel the quickening of the pace.
Monty Walsh, cowboy. Born in 1843, died when he had to. Don't ask if he was real, because he was as real as the West.
Okay, Matt, what's your number two?
My number two is all of the other failed origin movies of the 1980s. Okay, so we mentioned in the introduction of the episode that 1978 Superman was a big influence on The Legend of the Lone Ranger, but its reach went a lot further than that. Having lived through that period, I can tell you firsthand that movie screens in the 1980s were awash in failed origin stories, each one a pricey disappointment. The decade began with Mike Hodges' tacky sci-fi throwback Flash Gordon, which cost more money to make than The Empire Strikes Back, but which received only mixed reviews at the time. Although it turned a small profit, any sequels that may have been planned never materialized. Origin movies set in the jungle didn't fare any better. In addition to 1984's Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, which was based on Will Eisner's comic book character, there were two Tarzan movies, Bo Derek's 1981 Tarzan the Ape Man, and Hugh Hudson's Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, in 1984. All three were jungle epics designed to launch franchises, and all three died on the vine, so to speak. Other failed comic book movies of the 80s include Swamp Thing, Supergirl, Red Sonja, and Howard the Duck, which is a movie that I love dearly, but which most people seem to think is unwatchable. Then there was 1985's Remo Williams' The Adventure Begins, which was based on a series of paperback novels about a blue-collar secret agent. Now, when you include the phrase "The Adventure Begins" in your title, it's pretty obvious that you're planning to launch a series, but viewers had no interest in Remo Williams, so The Adventure Ends might have been more fitting. 1981, however, really was the banner year for movies like this, because in addition to The Lone Ranger and Bo Derek's Tarzan, we were also subjected to Zorro the Gay Blade and Charlie Chan and the Curse of the Dragon Queen, all in one year, and all of them based on long-dormant properties and none of them attracting viewers. The question is, what went wrong? Well, one answer might be the sheer glut of titles that flooded the market all of a sudden in the wake of Superman, like the Halloween-inspired slasher movie fad that was taking place at the exact same time. Audiences just got burned out. Also, many of these movies were troubled productions made by filmmakers whose connection to the material was loose at best. The truth is, many of these films just weren't very good in the first place. Supergirl, Swamp Thing, and Sheena were just lousy movies, so it's no wonder they bombed. Finally, there's something inherently wrong, I think, about planning a franchise before the first movie even comes out. Just ask the makers of the recent Stephen King adaptation, The Dark Tower, who proudly announced a full slate of ancillary TV series and sequels before anyone had even seen how bad the movie was. In Western terms, you might say the problem amounts to putting the cart before the horse, or something like that, but Anyway, Andrew, what's your take on this?
Great observation, Matt. And I was thinking about this a lot as I watched the movie, and I think it's helpful to know this broader context that The Legend of the Lone Ranger was part of a trend, but was in fact representative of that trend in the way that it didn't succeed. You know, I obviously spend a lot of my time talking about movies with young people, and it's often difficult for them to believe that there was a time not very long ago when sequels and series were rare because many films with sequel potential bombed. And even with successful films, there was a reluctance to release more of them. It could be that, you know, once upon a time, you had to give up the media that you enjoyed as a child because it was no longer socially acceptable, or because there just wasn't a way to physically have it on VHS, or you had thrown away all of your comic books. That's no longer an issue today. I mean, all of us have access to an immense archive of material. I think we all have our own immense personal archives of material that stretch back to our own childhoods. So I think our connection to the media that we've consumed over the course of our lives is a little bit different. And maybe films like Star Wars and Superman were kind of the thin end of the wedge. And we get to a point today where there's no longer any stigma and people are easily able to access what at once upon a time would have been much more niche culture.
Another thing to remember about these films from the 80s is that, like Legend of the Lone Ranger, a lot of them lacked a major star in the lead role. So for these films, you had people like Miles O'Keefe, Tanya Roberts, Sam J. Jones, and Helen Slater as the lead characters. These are not actors that you really want to spend a lot of time with. So that didn't help sell tickets. And it really wasn't until Tim Burton's Batman that I think filmmakers realized that even these comic book movies needed a star of the magnitude of Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson in their casts. It wasn't enough just to have a character that we've seen before. A similar thing also happened, though, for a brief period in the 90s, where you had movies like The Shadow with Alec Baldwin and The Phantom with Billy Zane, The Saint with Val Kilmer, as well as The Rocketeer, Dick Tracy, and Tank Girl. There were all these properties coming out at once, and none of them caught on either.
Yeah, I guess we get a similar moment post-Batman as we did post-Superman.
Right.
And those cycles actually run a similar course where, you know, the Superman franchise lasts for four movies, there's kind of dwindling returns, and nobody else is really able to replicate it. You know, likewise with Batman, you know, it first comes out, but, you know, we don't get any more Superman movies. What we do get are these sort of other more obscure characters from a lot of them from, you know, the 1930s and 40s who also never quite catch on. And they're obviously made to be budget conscious in some ways. You know, The Shadow has, is it Alec Baldwin?
Yeah.
In the lead, I believe. So, you know, he's a big name, but, you know, these still aren't blockbuster films in the way that a Star Wars is. They're really period pieces. So they're trying to find ways to manage the budget. And as you said, they just never quite catch on. And this is sort of what I'm referring to when I talk to students today about superhero movies. You know, in the wake of Batman, we did actually get some Marvel movies that people forget about. We get the horrible Captain America low-budget film made in Eastern Europe, and we get the never-released Roger Corman Fantastic Four. So there wasn't much appetite for these movies, even after the demonstrated success of a blockbuster like a Batman. Again, it's really not until, you know, the turn of the millennium when something flips. And, you know, suddenly we do get a film like X-Men, but then we get so much more.
The Tarzan, Lone Ranger, Zorro Adventure Hour, Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle. The Lone Ranger rides again to fight for law and order in the Old West. In early California, one man rides into the night to fight the forces of tyranny. With his swift blade, he carves out justice and leaves the mark of Zorro. Through the jungle, across the plains, and out of the night come and the Three Champions of Justice in the Tarzan, Lone Ranger, Zorro Adventure Hour.
My number two is the film's many references and homages to other Westerns. From the 1970s up to the present day, filling your new Western movie with as many references to classic Westerns as possible has been standard operating procedure for any Western filmmaker. The Legend of the Lone Ranger is no different, and it would take far too long to enumerate the many ways it invokes and evokes earlier films. From its Man Who Knows Indians passages, to its Anthony Mann-like revenge plot, to Italian Western-inspired elements like the politically aspirant villain and his paramilitary force and Gatling gun. As I said a minute ago, the Westerns of John Ford loom especially large. Elements from Stagecoach, Rio Grande, The Searchers are all restaged in The Legend of the Lone Ranger. The movie really does approach a Once Upon a Time in the West level of citations of earlier Westerns. Now, this makes the film an interesting synthesis of the two main strands in Western movie history. Now, there's an important and consequential distinction to be made between A Westerns and B Westerns. Now, this is a topic that deserves an entire episode, if not several episodes, but in broad strokes, B Westerns were short, quickly made, low-budget pictures produced in large numbers in the 30s and 40s. They starred actors like Tom Mix, Ken Maynard, Buck Jones, and Tim McCoy. And plot-wise, they tended to be less concerned with American history than with action. A Westerns were longer, more expensive Westerns and weren't made in large numbers until the early 1940s. And when they rose to A status, they featured stars like Tyrone Power or Gary Cooper. And many of these films offered more serious dramatizations of the process of westward expansion. Now, when most of us talk about Western movies, and this is certainly the case on this podcast, we're talking about A Westerns. Yet B Westerns have an equal, if not larger, cachet among Western fans. There's an argument to be made that, with the decline of the B movie in the late 1940s and 50s, the B Western migrated to or was replaced by television Westerns, whose serialized narratives were much more like B-Westerns than they were like big-budget A-Westerns. If you go to any Western fan convention today, you'll see lots of attention devoted to B-Western movies of the 30s and 40s and to television series of the 50s and 60s. But you'll see comparatively, even surprisingly, little interest in canonical Westerns like Shane or High Noon. So where am I going with this? Well, The Lone Ranger, with his origin in radio and prominence on television, belongs squarely to the B tradition of serialized Western production. And I think The Legend of the Lone Ranger retains much more of the spirit of the B Western than critics at the time acknowledged. And maybe they weren't in a position to acknowledge it. I don't think a lot of fans of A Westerns are in a position to really appreciate the B Western. So in a sense, The Legend of the Lone Ranger is really the most expensive B Western ever made. It's a B-Western that takes seminal moments from some of the greatest Westerns of all time and stages them on a larger scale than even John Ford could imagine.
Wow, I have never thought about it that way before. The largest scale B-Western, it makes so much sense. Is that one of the reasons why it was so critically panned? That, I mean, those aside from hardcore fans, I think the B-Westerns just put people off who are just want to try a Western or just like film in general. There's something about that where you really have to be a devoted fan.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly was in the 30s and even into the 40s, especially in the 30s, there was a real stigma around B-Westerns because they were very popular, but they were popular with certain demographics, very popular in the South, popular in the West, popular in rural areas. So really, they were popular with poor people. And so studios were reluctant to make large prestigious pictures because they didn't think that that audience would be interested in what came to be a Western subject matter. So I think that stigma, that stigma around low budget Westerns certainly persists, that there wasn't the same interest in history. There wasn't the same attention to detail. I think that persists. But a lot of it, I think, is also just plain ignorance. The Lone Ranger was insanely popular, but you know, was it popular with the types of people who go on to become film critics at the New York Times? I mean, maybe I'm doing a great disservice to Janet Maslin here, but I don't think so. And the more I think about it, the more I think the film's kind of earnest embrace of what the Lone Ranger really was just plain confusing for not only a lot of film critics, but I think a lot of film goers.
Some of the references that you mentioned to other classic films that are piled on one after another in this film, one of the things I like about them is that they don't feel so wink-wink,
yeah,
where
right,
they're trying to show you, get it, this is like so-and-so. You've seen this before in Django. You've seen this before
right,
in something. Whereas we do get those kind of winking things these days, I think, in some Westerns that want to comment on the genre.
Yeah.
And those always take me right out of the experience. So I appreciate here that those references and similarities to other films and callbacks are sort of woven carefully through there. They don't stand out as sore thumbs in a way.
I agree. There's a decided lack of pretension in the way that the film engages with Western movie history. And to me, that's one of the great pleasures of the film, that it's not, as you say, a filmmaker subtly saying to you, oh, look how much I know about the Western. It's more about, these are great moments from Westerns, but they're great because they have a certain timelessness to them. And why don't we just try to see if we can insert them here and, spend a little bit more money on them. Okay, Matt, here's the moment that I know I've been waiting for. What is your number one?
My number one is my own slight connection to Lone Ranger cinema. So back in 2009, when I was writing a bunch of TV movies for different cable networks, a producer that I knew hired me to adapt a novel called On the Silver Bullet Trail. Published in 1994, the book was written by Dodd Hesse, a professional golf instructor turned author. Hesse's novel was a quasi-mystery about a screenwriter who wanders up and down the coast of California in search of information about Franz Stryker, the creator of the iconic Lone Ranger. Hesse's book jumps back and forth in time, providing historical clues about the origin of the Ranger character. Some of those clues were based on Hesse's own research, while others seem more like figments of his imagination. Now, On the Silver Bullet Trail was not a well-structured novel, but as a Lone Ranger fan, I quickly signed on to adapt it regardless. So for the next year, I wrote 6 drafts of the script, and each one had Franz Stryker as the main character. Like the novel, the script was filled with flashbacks to the Old West, including a detailed subplot about the legendary Mexican bandit Joaquin Murrieta, who terrorized settlers and miners in California in the 1850s. According to Hesse's novel, Murrieta not only inspired the creation of Zorro, but the Lone Ranger as well. Writing scenes, though, featuring Franz Stryker was the best part of the project. Personally, whenever I write a character, I like to picture a real-life actor and tailor the dialogue to them. For Stryker, I imagined Jason Robards, star of Legend of the Lone Ranger. Robard's crusty persona fit my version of Stryker like a glove, and writing his cantankerous dialogue in that voice was just an absolute blast. Now, one of the strangest things about this particular script was that the producers decided at some point that they wanted to set the story in the early 80s, shortly after the premiere of The Legend of the Lone Ranger. Unfortunately, the real Franz Stryker died in 1962, so the fact that he was still alive in our movie seemed like a pretty big problem to me. But the producers didn't agree, and since they were the ones footing the bill, the reality of the story began to change. Honestly, though, that wasn't such a bad thing. In some ways, it just made the script more interesting. With Franz Stryker still alive, it meant that literally anything could happen in our movie, which might explain why we ended up adding a bunch of Yakuza to the script halfway through development. Sadly, like so many projects in Hollywood, our decidedly unique adaptation of On the Silver Bullet Trail didn't move forward. They shopped it around for a while, but it never went beyond that. However, all is not entirely lost. You see, the rights to Hesse's book reverted back to him, and a new adaptation, now retitled Kemosabe, is currently being developed by a production company, and it's apparently written by Hesse himself. Of course, there's no guarantee that his version will have any better luck than ours did, but the description online of Hesse's script includes several details that were the brainchild of yours truly. So if you happen to see a movie about the creation of the Lone Ranger on Netflix someday, and it includes a Yakuza action scene for absolutely no reason, well, I hope you enjoy the movie.
I don't know what to say. In any of your drafts, did the film The Legend of the Lone Ranger, did that play a role at all?
It comes up, it's not mentioned, but at one point, the main character, this guy, Will Duggan, the screenwriter, is talking to Fran Stryker's daughter, and she thinks he's trying to get the rights to The Lone Ranger, and she says, no, no, he'll never give you the rights to that film, not after that last movie that they made, and it's a reference to The Legend of the Lone Ranger, because this script took place about a year after that film.
Okay.
So it's obliquely referenced, but it doesn't come right out and say it.
Okay. Wow. Well, I would love to see a movie about the life of Fran Stryker. You know, I don't actually know that much about him other than the fact that, one, he created the Lone Ranger and was also incredibly prolific, not only with the Ranger. I think he wrote Lone Ranger either comics as well and wrote a lot of Green Hornet. So I know that he was incredibly productive. One nice thing about The Legend of the Lone Ranger is the kind of the honor that it pays to Fran Stryker by naming a couple of characters.
Right.
The newspaper man, Lucas Stryker, and his daughter, Amy Stryker, after Fran Stryker. So the characters in the movie are kind of the chroniclers, the initial chroniclers of the Lone Ranger. Or I suppose in the alternative timeline, Legend of the Lone Ranger mythos, those are probably the distant relatives, the ancestors of Fran Stryker, right? And then the Lone Ranger story gets passed down through the ages to him, right? That's probably the fourth or fifth movie that it was going to happen. Wow, amazing. I got to ask, where did the Yakuza come from? Was there a Yakuza movie around that? Like, was this around Kill Bill or something like that?
No, it was, there was just a little bit in the novel about a Japanese company that was doing some mining in the area where the character is. So as I'm looking through the original novel, trying to find things to develop, that one stood out for me. And I kind of mentioned it to them. I said, you know, what would be cool is if we did this. And of course, that immediately became like, let's do that. So throughout the process, one of the cool things was we organized two live table reads to fine-tune things. It's nice sometimes to hear actual actors read your script, and you start getting an idea of what dialogue doesn't work, what scenes seem like they're not working in any good way. So they brought in 12 actors on two different occasions, the professional actors. These guys were really good. And they just read the script from start to finish. And we were able to figure out certain characters needed more work or certain ones could be cut altogether. So I got to hear what it would have sounded like if they actually made the movie, which was still pretty fun. Okay, Andrew, what is your number one?
My number one is Clinton Spilsbury. The vast majority of the negative response to The Legend of the Lone Ranger falls squarely on the shoulders of this handsome newcomer. Reading accounts of the movie's production, it's hard to know what to make of Mr. Spilsbury. Was he a genuinely nice guy in over his head who did his best under difficult circumstances? Or a stubborn, untrained actor who let the promise of fame go to his head? Was he a drunk who was banned from two Santa Fe bars for starting fights? Or had he just been defending himself from local tough guys wanting to pick fights with the Lone Ranger? Some of the crew resented the production accommodating Spilsbury's expensive request to film the movie in sequence so he could better convey the emotional arc of his character. Yet he made this request because he believed he wasn't a good enough actor to perform his scenes out of order. Further muddying the waters is the decision to have all of Spilsbury's dialogue dubbed by actor James Keach. "It wasn't that his voice was high or low or had a strange tenor to it," explained co-star John Bennett Perry. "It just kind of came out the same way all the time. There wasn't any passion." Keach, for his part, didn't think Spilsbury's delivery was that bad, but wasn't about to turn down an easy, well-paying job. Word about the dubbing, of course, leaked to the press, forcing Spilsbury to defend himself while promoting the movie. "They wouldn't have hired me if they hadn't liked my voice," he said at the time. What, then, can we plausibly say about Spilsbury's performance? Honestly, it's fine. He's fine. He's no Christopher Reeve, but then neither are any of the other actors plucked from obscurity to headline blockbuster movies. The other better actors in Legend of the Lone Ranger have no trouble playing off Spilsbury, and the contrast between his upright acting and the looser performances of his co-stars more or less works in the movie's favor. Frankly, the expectation that what was always a one-dimensional character should be more than that is a little odd to me. Reading reviews of the movie, I was struck by a recurring contradiction. On the one hand, the film should have been more like the TV show, less violent, more child-friendly, and so on. But on the other, it should have also been more contemporary, with less stereotypical characters and maybe some self-reflexive commentary. As Mr. Spilsbury discovered, it's hard to have it both ways.
You know, it's weird. I can easily picture the film without Merle Haggard's narration, but for some reason I can't picture it without Spilsbury's dubbing. It's just so much part of the legend of the Legend of the Lone Ranger. Of course, he wasn't the only actor around this time period to have their performance dubbed. Andy McDowell in Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, is completely dubbed by Glenn Close because McDowell's southern accent just didn't work for the character. Sam Jones in Flash Gordon had about half of his lines dubbed by a sound-alike because either he didn't deliver them correctly or he was just sort of a jerk on set and they just didn't want him around. Then in Superman, Jeff East, who plays the young Clark Kent, didn't learn that he had been dubbed by Christopher Reeve until he saw the film in the premiere. He found out then that he wasn't speaking in the film anymore. But in Spilsbury's case, you know, James Keach, I think, does a decent job there. He has his own connection to the Western, so I think he understands how to play that character, and it all works in a nice way. I'll say this, Spilsbury looks the business in this movie. He really does. He looks that great in each of those Ranger personas, both as the young lawyer John Reed, as the Native American John Reed, and as, of course, the Ranger himself. He just looks great in the suit. So, you know, like you said, he's fine.
Yeah, it's funny to read a lot of the sort of retrospective criticism of the movie by people associated with the production. You know, they all point to the fact that Spilsbury got the role because he looked like the Lone Ranger. You know, he looked good in the mask in particular because his, you know, eyes weren't too close together. And they're all saying this as if that was a bad thing and the way you shouldn't go about casting the movie. But to me, that's where you should begin, because the character is so much about how he looks. The appearance, the impression that you get upon seeing him is so much of who the Lone Ranger is. You know, Christopher Reeve looks like Superman. They just happen to get the bonus of him being a talented actor. I don't think it's that much of an issue in this movie.
Although his reputation was legendary, his identity remained a secret. For he rode to fame on a white stallion with his trusted Indian friend and a black mask across his face.
I want you to take me to Cavendish.
Now, the truth is told, and the mask is lifted in The Legend of the Lone Ranger. Rated PG. Starts Friday at a selected theater near you.
Well, that about wraps things up for this Lone Ranger episode. Until next time, I'm Matthew Chernoff.
And I'm Andrew Patrick Nelson. And you've been listening to How the West Was Cast.
Well, that was our show. We thank you kindly for listening and hope you'll come back again real soon. Till then, Keep your saddle oiled and your guns greased. We'll be seeing you.